Men's Health magazine just celebrated his 35th birthday, and they had like 33 of the greatest quotes we've ever seen over the 35 years of our existence. And one of them was mine, which was ridiculous. It was like Bill Clinton and, you know, Bishop Desmond Tutu, and then Chris Winter. And Chris Winter's quotation was, which is what I say a lot, "Just because you can do it doesn't mean you should."
Welcome in to another episode of the Professional Profiles podcast that uncovers the time-tested wisdom for the next generation. Join me, a forward-thinking teen, as I engage in insightful conversations with industry titans, revealing the invaluable ingredients that pave the way to achieving remarkable success. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Profiles Podcast. Today, I'm lucky to introduce Dr. Christopher Winter, who's a sleep medicine expert who has been a leader in the field since 1993. He's the best-selling author of The Sleep Solution. He also hosts a top 20 podcast called Sleep Unplugged. Along with that, he conducts groundbreaking research on sleep and athletic performance. He has consulted with major sports teams, including MLB and NBA teams, and is the sleep specialist for the U.S. women's soccer team. Beyond sports, he's a sought-after speaker for companies and organizations. With board certifications in sleep medicine and neurology, Dr. Winter is a distinguished scholar committed to advancing our understanding of sleep's impact on health and performance. I really hope you enjoyed this wonderful interview, and if you did, be sure to share it with someone that can use it. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure they will too. Here's the interview. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Winter. I really appreciate your time, and I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Absolutely, Charlie. It's a pleasure being on your podcast.
So can we just talk first about what your career looked like?
Yeah. So I think from a young age, I decided I was interested in medicine. I'm not entirely sure why. You know, when you think about why would a third grader be interested in medicine? You know, I think that there was a combination of it was a career choice that got people around me excited. You know, my parents and my grandparents, it seemed to be a very respectable choice. I did well in school when I was little. I was pretty smart. And so it felt like, well, if you're smart, you should become a doctor. Like that's what the smart kids, you know, like so there's all these kind of unusual things that lead you to make a declaration of career when you're, you know, still sitting in a lunchroom cafeteria, you know, hoping for pizza day kind of thing. When I went to college, I still wanted to be a doctor, but it starts to kind of dawn on you, and maybe it dawns on a lot of your listeners, even when you do make a career choice, a lot of times you're like, I don't really know what's involved with that, versus you want to be a professional baseball player and your dad's a professional baseball player. I think those kids often succeed because they see everything all their life, exactly what it takes to be a pro. You know, unless your parent does something that you're interested in, I think it's kind of hard. So when I got to college, I asked an advisor, hey, I think I want to be a doctor. Is there any way I could work with doctors? And he presented me with the option to work with several, and one was a sleep doctor. And I thought, well, this is kind of cool. I didn't even know that was a field, and started working with him. And the combination of how interesting the field was and how nice he was and what a great mentor he was just sort of set the trajectory, which is why I think internships, even if they're not paid, mentorship, shadowing, anytime you can get around people that do something, it's going to be enlightening. Either, wow, I really like this and want to do it, or this is absolutely not for me and I can check it off my list of things to do. But maybe there were some elements, I didn't like the job, but I certainly liked their flexibility, or I liked the fact that they were working in a stimulating environment, you know, or what. So I think that, you know, it's okay to not know what you want to do. I think you just have to keep putting yourself out there around people who are doing things, and then you just kind of pick and choose the aspects of what they do and make it your own, I guess.
For sure. So like right now, what would a typical day look like for you? Because I know you have a bunch of different sections in your career and your duties. So could you walk us through what those are?
Yeah. So at the core, even though I don't know it's still at the core financially, at the core of what I feel like I do is take care of patients. So I am a doctor. I went to 4 years of medical school, and then I did a neurology residency. So I'm a neurologist by training. And at the core, I see adults and kids in my clinic and help them with sleep problems. So there are some neurologists who deal with strokes and some who deal with Alzheimer's and memory disorder and some who are much more general and do all kinds of things. I'm specifically sort of rooted in sleep disorders. So at the core of what I do, I see patients, you know, Monday through Friday and talk about, hey, I have trouble sleeping or I'm excessively sleepy and can never seem to wake up. And we deal with those problems and order tests and manage solutions. I also work for professional sports organizations and help their players and organization as a whole deal with sleep issues and travel and jet lag and the ins and outs of essentially being shift workers. And so manage that aspect of what the teams do. And then I do a lot of writing, either for, you know, magazines or online outlets. I've written two books. One's called The Sleep Solution. The other's called The Rested Child. And then I guess the last part of the pie would be just sort of lecturing. I enjoy educating, you know, going to a company and giving a lecture to all of the employees. I got to spend time at a college recently and interact with different student groups and athletic organizations and faculty and literally spent two whole days just going from one group to another and talking about sleep. And it was absolutely delightful. Answering questions, you know, some people are like you, I think I might like to do what you do. It sounds really cool. And other people are struggling with their sleep. So, you know, one of the things I like about what I do is that it's very, it's extremely variable. You know, I looked at orthopedic surgery and thought this is really cool, but it looks like that path leads you to replacing somebody's left or right knee three times a day for the rest of your life. It didn't, I'm sure there's some pretty dynamic orthopedic surgeon lecturers out there, you know, but you don't, sleep is kind of one of those sort of touchstone things that if you're on a plane and you're like, hey, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, I operate on knees, somebody might like, oh yeah, my uncle had a knee replacement. He said it was the best thing in his life. And then you're done. But tell somebody on a plane you're a sleep doctor or a sleep scientist, and man, it's just, you're not going to sleep on that plane. So I love the idea that maybe I would not enjoy seeing patients in the future. I certainly love it now, but if that happened, then you could kind of migrate your career to more lecturing. Or if you really didn't like working with sports teams, I'll write another book. So I like that sort of multifaceted aspect of the career, because one of the things I tell young people is life is long. Can you see yourself doing that thing today and 30 years from now? And if the answer is yes, then you should probably do it. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's like, every day that I get to replace somebody's knee is the best day of my life. But knowing myself and looking at that, I thought, I think this will be difficult for me over time to not be able to flex a certain creativity or, you know, creative writing or something. But again, I'm sure there's an orthopedic surgeon who's listening to saying that's not true. I do all kinds of that kind of stuff, but I just didn't see it really for me.
So I'm fascinated with your work with sports teams. So I'd love to just isolate that for a bit and talk about that. So how do you actually work with them and help optimize their performance? Could you walk through kind of some of your main ideas to what you're telling them and working with them?
Yeah, I think the best thing you can do is to kind of think of it in terms of a micro situation and a macro, in the sense that if you're talking about the Oklahoma City Thunder, there is what can we do as an organization to promote better sleep, rest, and recovery for everyone, the players, the strength and conditioning coaches, the medical staff, the unbelievable woman who takes care of all the travel logistics for everyone. I mean, everybody's got their role to play and every one of them needs their sleep. And I think there's a tendency to focus on the people out there who are handling the basketball. But really, for an organization to be successful, everybody needs to be well slept. So there's, what can I do in terms of looking at the organization as a whole and work to improve the way they get their rest and recovery? And then the micro is, you know, John Smith, starting center, Frank Thomas, power forward, Sean Grinnell, the center. Like, how can I deal with those hypothetical individuals and specifically deal with Frank's new twins that have just been born and are disrupting his ability to get sleep when he's home. And Sean really struggles to sleep on the airplane because he's so tall and he doesn't quite fit in the seat. And, you know, the other guy who just doesn't really feel like sleep's that important and would much rather stay up playing video games and meeting potential partner, you know, romantic partners after games when he should be at home icing, resting, and recovering. So that's a lot of fun too. I just got finished writing up a bunch of reports of the meetings I had with a particular NBA team. So I met with a bunch of their players and I'm sending back reports to their medical staff saying, this guy looks great. He's got a good sleep schedule and situation going. This guy has got every piece of electronics on all through the night and feels like he can't sleep without it. So how can we start deconstructing this idea that he needs episodes of Friends playing all through the night in order to sleep? Because that's his belief now, that if Friends isn't playing, then he's not sleeping. You know, what can we do in terms of, I was talking, one of the players actually sleepwalks. And it's never been a problem. But imagine this team is now on the road and they're in Dallas and in a hotel and he walks out of his hotel room naked, which everybody always, whenever you sleepwalk in a hotel, you're always naked or just about naked. So now this famous NBA person's walking down the hallway naked. Maybe he walks into somebody else's room. Maybe he walks up to somebody who's just standing in the hallway looking for ice naked. And they take that as being kind of threatening. And now they're reporting to the front desk, some guy, huge guy, naked, was trying to do something to me while I was, and you talk to the guy, and he's like, I don't remember anything that happened, because most people are completely amnestic when they have it. And there's a lot of weird legal stuff that goes along with sleepwalking. I was just an expert witness in a case in a hospital where a father who was there with his son sleptwalked out of his bed and got in bed with the kid and his mother next door to him. Like it just... Yeah, and had no recollection of doing it. So, you know, it's these individuals at the end of the day are just human beings and individuals like you and me. But, you know, making sure we document the fact that he sleepwalks, making sure the team's aware of that, taking some extra precautions to make sure that something terrible doesn't happen that could easily be avoided.
So everyone talks about sleep being so important, or at least as a high schooler, I see friends and peers that are willing to sacrifice their sleep in order to do more important work. What's so problematic with this mindset? Like, why do we always hear people older or experts talking about the importance of sleep?
Yeah, that's a tough one. It is important, but it's important like buying a new car and eventually seeing a tiny speck of rust on it and somebody saying, you've got to take care of that immediately or else you're going to lose your car. No, you're not. Bullshit. Like if you look at that piece, you know, if you 3 days later, that rust spot probably hasn't changed a bit, at least to your naked eye. So it's not wrong to say that that rust is a problem. It's just not an imminent problem, or at least one we can see very easily. So it's a rare thing to find a 16, 17-year-old who is truly concerned about their health and well-being in their mid-50s. I wasn't. So there's two problems here. One is we're relying on a 16, 17, 18-year-old to say, you know what? I heard there is a slip and slide champagne fraternity mixer going on Friday night at this place. I'm going to not go to that, because I need to make sure I get plenty of sleep because I don't want to be, you know, having health problems when I'm in mid-50s. No, you're going to like, are you kidding me? Like there's people out there just slipping and sliding at this college and like in various states of undress. Yeah, you're going to be there. You're going to be there until they shut it down at 3 o'clock in the morning, most likely. I mean, who wouldn't be? So that's part of the problem. The second part of the problem is we reward the person that you just described. So he's probably in your class. They're in your class and you're going to make a decision tonight at 11 o'clock. Look, I got a lot of work to do, but my sleep's more important to me. So I'm going to go to bed. And that other person is not, they're going to stay up later. They're going to study. They're going to put more effort into their presentation. They're going to put more effort into their studying and they'll probably do better than you because they had extra hours to get work done that you didn't have. So at the end of the year, when that individual is making the valedictorian speech and they get into the college that you didn't get into, how do you feel about that? So it's not a real fair fight. And, you know, it's interesting. I've got kids who are, you know, they used to be in high school, and I would say to them, you should go to bed. I'll just call your school tomorrow and tell them you're not going to, you know, bring this assignment and you need another day to do it, because I don't think you should be sacrificing your sleep to make a poster for driver's ed. And I remember one time my daughter said, please don't do that. Number one, I just don't want to be that kid. Nobody wants their father calling up and, you know, being angry. But the second thing is, she said, Dad, it doesn't matter. Sure, you can get me an extra day to do this assignment, but there's just more assignments coming. So sure, I'll have an extra day to do this, but now I've got all my homework for the next day to do. So I'll be behind on that while I'm working. So I described it in my latest book. It's like a conveyor belt. There's a great scene of the old sitcom I Love Lucy where they're having to box chocolates and they start to get behind. And then all hell breaks loose because nobody's turning the conveyor belt off. You know, telling a kid, hey, just take some extra time with assignment only works if a school is willing to shut the conveyor belt off every now and then, let everybody take a breath, get caught up. And that's not what I see in a typical 2023 high school right now. It's the conveyor belt gets turned on faster and faster. And you know, they'll talk that, hey, listen, if your child needs extra time for their assignment, you just let us know, we'll give it to them. Great. But they're not slowing down the rest of the assignments. So every kid knows it's a mirage. So I don't know what we do about the fact that we ultimately reward people who will sacrifice their sleep. It was like one time when I was buying a car, I was like, I don't want to buy a big SUV. My wife's like, we have to buy a big SUV because everybody else has big SUVs. If we're in an accident, we can't be in a little car when everybody else is driving big cars. So what, we're making our decision about what size car to buy based upon what other people are buying and the potential for getting into an accident. It's like an arms race, you know? So I don't have a great answer for that question, but what you're describing absolutely exists. All I can say is be aware of it. Know when you're staying up late to get the work done so you can get the A on the test that you're probably not doing great things for your body. It's like alcohol. I don't think anybody goes to the party and thinks, okay, I'm going to drink some alcohol tonight. This is going to be good for me in the long run. No, you're like, this isn't good for me, but I'm going to do it anyway because of peer pressure or whatever. I got to look cool. I don't want to be, you know, talked about in bad ways. I'll pretend like I'm drinking a beer or whatever. But I think as long as people understand that what they're doing is not good, and when you have the opportunity to sleep, sleep. Don't fall back on, well, I'll just sleep later. So sure, get the assignment done, get an A on it. But you know, this weekend or on Wednesday night when you have nothing going on, maybe go to bed a little earlier instead of being on your phone until 2 o'clock in the morning. Like, use that time because you've got it now. Don't waste the opportunities you're given.
What are some of these negative health side effects that you're seeing that are correlated with not as much sleep as one should have?
I think the ones that probably resonate the most are the more immediate ones. I mean, I could tell you dementia. I could tell you heart disease. If you ask me, oh, really, Chris, you've seen a lot of high schoolers and college students with dementia and heart disease because they're not getting enough sleep? No, haven't seen one. The score stands 0 heart disease, 0 dementia in my 18 to 28-year-old demographic as of today. So I think the things that really resonate more have to do with emotional health, anxiety and depression, concentration and focus, memory. I think those things, mood, I think those things are much more susceptible to immediate bad sleep. I'm going to just, you know, for the next couple of weeks, you know, while my sport is in, I'm playing basketball and we got practices that go late, I'm dating this person, I'm going to see them. And then I'm also going to try to get my work done and get straight A's so I can get into, you know, Harvard or the University of Virginia, wherever you want to go. I think that those things are the most pressing. So if I have a young person who's really struggling emotionally, and there's so many people that are right now, sleep's a great target. You know, are you really doing the most you can with your sleep? Like, tell me about your sleep schedule and be honest. I'm not here to judge. I mean, if you're like, look, I generally don't turn the lights out until 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm just addicted to video games or chatting with my friends, or I just like to read. I mean, even if it's a noble pursuit, I have a goal to read the entire, you know, encyclopedia, you know, whatever, you know, I'm doing high level research until 2 a.m. Yeah. I think that you have to start to kind of get priorities sort of in line. At Men's Health Magazine just celebrated its 35th birthday, and they had like 33 of the greatest quotes we've ever seen over the 35 years of our existence. And one of them was mine, which was ridiculous. It was like Bill Clinton and, Bishop Desmond Tutu, and then Chris Winter. And Chris Winter's quotation was, which is what I say a lot, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should, in terms of like staying up late. Like, I'm good at staying up late. One of the reasons I became a doctor is that being on call was a piece of cake for me. Like, I could stay up all night and be okay the next day. It's not good for your health, though. Like, I'm probably subtracting days, minutes, weeks off of my life by doing it. So at some point, I had the come to Jesus moment of, I could stay up all night and paint the basement as a 38-year-old or whatever, but is that a good use of my time? I mean, does the basement really have to get painted on this specific Tuesday night? I could just get some sleep, do what's right for my health, and paint it this weekend or whatever. You know, so these are the things that I wrestle with. You know, like, there are people who are nervous about not getting enough sleep. Some people need to be more nervous about not getting enough sleep. And, you know, as long as I get 4 hours, I'm good to go. Like, we have to be careful of those people as well, too. So, I think that's, but these things take time to cultivate, I think.
Right. So as our society has shifted to having more screens in their house and allowing screens in bedrooms, have you seen kind of maybe the quality of the average person's sleep go down? Or like, what are the problems associated with allowing technology into where we're sleeping?
The answer is yes, absolutely. And I like the fact that I bridged the generation of, I remember the time, I was a huge Star Wars fan growing up. And I remember, you know, once, it seemed like once a year, CBS would broadcast Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back on network television. You know, doing a little movie thing came out, and it always started at 9. And, you know, you'd read TV Guide. Oh my gosh, Mom, Tuesday, 9 o'clock, they're doing Star Wars. And that was the only time you had to watch it. I remember when being really little and my parents would be like, you have to go to bed at 10:30. I'm like, but it ends at 11:10. Like, I can't stop. You know, I would sneak out of my room and look around the corner and watch, you know, it was just, but if it wasn't being broadcast, you had zero access to it. I can't imagine being a young person who's been given, hey, you want to watch Star Wars? You can literally watch it anytime you want on this little thing that you have in your hand. I mean, talk about just the most addictive of drugs. Oh, by the way, not only Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back, but like a million other Star Wars movies and shows and da, da, da. And there's, you know, if you think you've seen them all, there's one getting ready to come out every 2 to 3 months. Like, it just, so I just can't imagine being a young person trying to navigate that. And, you know, my oldest daughter came along with the most rudimentary of the iPod shuffles and things. And then as my kids got progressively more kids, each one was born into a period of even more technology. And so my youngest, you know, definitely, I think, struggles the most with it, the middle child, and then my oldest is definitely not as much. But I think it's a remarkably massive hurdle. What can compete with it? You know, what in your life is better than just any movie that's ever been made? You can watch it right now, probably for free. And not to mention the, you know, all the stuff that you'd sneak around to look at when you were little, like, that stuff's everywhere. I don't know how people kind of manage that. I think it's a very massive problem for parents, but ultimately it's your life. So your parents can hide your phone and they can turn the internet off. But I've never met a kid who can't get around these things if they really want to. I mean, one of my kids built a fake phone because we have a rule. We plug all our phones up in the kitchen. So he made a fake phone. every night he plugged the fake phone in. I didn't know until the power went out and noticed that when the power came back on, his phone didn't do anything. I walked over and looked at it. It was a piece of wood in an iPhone case. I mean, that's the level of, I'm going to lie every night and say I'm plugging my phone in and trick my dad and make this, you know, like, but I think I get it though. I mean, it's just, not to mention being connected with all of your friends. You know, like, wow, you mean I can just talk to the girl that I'm dating anytime, even when she's in bed at night? Wow. Like, I mean, this is for an 18-year-old to say, you know what, I'm going to turn my phone off around 9 or 10 o'clock and just, you know, you're also isolating yourself from a lot of your peers. Like, that's when all the good dialogue's going on, gossip. Hey man, we're playing a game together, all watching a movie together tonight. We have this big group chat going on. I mean, the pressures to be a part of that are immense. So I don't have great solutions for that. Again, it becomes the war. If everybody else is doing it and you're the one person who's not, that takes a lot of willpower.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that as, I guess, a policy in your household that your whole family plugs in their phones at night. Is that an intentional thing because of the fact that technology can mess up your sleep?
Yeah, I just think we need to be away from it from time to time. I mean, it's a weird thing. Like, I'll walk by and look at my phone. I'm like, oh my gosh, my wife paged me an hour ago. I feel badly. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's trying to get in touch with me. But then it's also followed by the feeling of, but I also just left my phone in a room and didn't care about it. Like, this, it can be there for a while and need to be with it all the time. So yeah, it was sort of born out of, here's your phone. It's plugged up in the kitchen. If you need to use it to get an assignment, communicate with a friend, check the weather, whatever you want to do, it's right here. You can use it. I'd just rather you not take it into your room. Let's leave the room for sleeping and, you know, kind of quiet reflection, whatever. And the phone can be used everywhere else in the entire world except for that one place. I really wanted to, and we do it too. I mean, in our own bedroom, I keep my phone plugged up in my office. My wife has her phone in the bedroom just as an alarm on the other side of the room, because we've just moved and we don't have a new. Plus, I think as a mother, she's like, what if my kids call in the middle of the night? We don't have a landline anymore. So there's little things that you can do, but we both don't need our phones in there. We're very careful about turning off any kind of alert, and we really don't look at it. It's just sitting over there. But if one of our kids calls, we will hear it. You know, if there's a crisis in the middle of the night, because our kids live far away from us. And so, but you know, trying to kind of create sort of a thoughtfulness and an expectation of, here's what I'm going to be on my phone. Like, my wife gets up in the morning and reads the news on her phone every morning. Or we'll do like a CNN news quiz or something. And that's her phone time. And then she gets up and has her coffee or makes tea, gets breakfast and goes to work. And I go to work. And I'm generally not on my phone during the day. So I think everybody has to come up with what's right for them. But yeah, it was an intentional decision to try to create phone-free time and phone-free spaces, which I think are really important.
So what are the strategies that you use with patients struggling to sleep that the average person could use to improve their sleep?
Yeah, I think the first strategy is probably learning about sleep. And that's why I wrote my first book. I thought there's a lot of sleep problems out there that are not necessarily sleep problems. They're more expectation problems or problems that arise when you don't really understand how sleep works. Like, this idea that everybody's going to sleep 8 hours is not true. The idea that if you get in bed and 20 minutes have passed and you haven't fallen asleep, that there's some sort of crisis that involves, you know, medication or treatment. No, you just got in bed and it took you a while to fall asleep. It's okay. Like, it's, sometimes you go to the restaurant and you don't feel like eating. So I just felt like there was such bad information out there about sleep and such bad treatment. So you went to your doctor and said you were having some trouble falling asleep, but they just gave you a pill that doesn't even have an FDA indication for sleep, just a sedative. Like, what? Why? I'd love to ask that doctor, why did you give that patient a pill? Well, he said he was having trouble falling asleep. Why did you give him a pill? You worried he's not going to sleep? You think not sleeping exists in nature? Like, you know, why? Or you just did it to get them out of your exam room. Like, so I feel like everything starts with good information. And for bright people, a lot of times the information all by itself solves the problem. I've been sleeping a solid 7 hours for all my life and feel great during the day. And I read this article that if you don't get 8 hours sleep, you're going to get dementia when you're in your 50s. So I've been trying to sleep eight. And it takes me 40 minutes to fall asleep every night. But when I was going trying to get 7 hours, I was going to sleep right away. Well, there, if you were doing well on 7 hours, weren't falling asleep during meetings, fell asleep pretty quickly, like sounds like eight is more than what your brain can really deliver. And that's okay. That's a genetic thing. Now, eight is the middle of a bell curve, maybe. It's probably closer to 7.5. So that means that, 70% of the population needs between 7 to 9 hours. So seven's fine if seven's the right thing for you. It's like a gymnast and a football player going to have lunch. The football player eats an entire pizza and a whole rotisserie chicken. The gymnast has a small salad and a little, fillet of salmon. And the football player could actually eat more. And the gymnast barely makes it through her. They're both elite in their own way, and they're both eating for themselves. If we take the average of the food they ate and say, okay, to be at your best, you need to eat a half a piece of pizza and, then the gymnast is going to say, I can't do it. I'm getting, a quarter of the way through my expected meal and I feel full and sick and it's really hard for me to eat the whole thing. I don't think I can do it. Great. I'm going to be a terrible gymnast. The football player is like, I'm starving. This is not enough food for me. Right, because we applied an average to an individual, which is always dangerous. So sure, if you're like, look, Chris, I want to try to get good sleep. What's a number I can start with? Start with seven, start with eight. I don't care. But then what happens? Oh, I'm exhausted only getting eight. Okay, then maybe 8.5 is better for you. I try to get eight, Chris, but I'm rarely able to get more than seven. And I just sit there and just looking at the ceiling because I'm not really that sleepy when I go to bed. Great, go to bed an hour later and get seven. So, to me, it's really about understanding sleep, because if you're just tuned into media, you get some really bizarre ideas about sleep. And a lot of them are based in fear. I always think about sleep like geometry. If you get inadequate sleep over a long period of time, then you develop dementia. Okay, we'll call that a theorem. Okay, that's probably true. So then if I get into bed tonight and it takes me 30 minutes to fall asleep, therefore I will get dementia. No. You can't say that. Like you applied that incorrectly. But so a lot of times these little nuances are sort of missed. No. It's not getting enough sleep over a long period of time. Plus, if you're constantly going to bed and it takes you a while to fall asleep, does that seem like the behavior of somebody who's sleep deprived? If you food deprive somebody and take them to a restaurant, would it surprise you if they couldn't find anything on the menu that looked good to eat? Of course it would. They'd order the first thing that they saw. Or they'd grab the first piece of food they see when they walked in the restaurant. They wouldn't care. They're starving to death. They're highly motivated to eat. They don't have a reduced motivation to eat. And so it's interesting when we look at things like insomnia and sleep deprivation, they're very different things. They're not the same thing. But if you look at the media, they use those things interchangeably. Yeah, if you're working two jobs and you've got about a 3-hour window to get your sleep, you're sleep deprived. You're probably going to fall asleep at a stoplight. You might wreck your car. That's very different from the person who says, it takes me 6 hours to fall asleep every night if I'm lucky. 6 hours? That's a long time, man. That's insomnia. Totally different thing. You talk to the person who's working two jobs and has 3 hours in between to sleep. They don't have a whole lot of trouble falling asleep. Like when they come home from that second job and they got 3 hours before they have to get up to go to the job number one, they're out cold and pretty hard to wake up. Yeah, because their body's not getting enough. So yeah, just a lot. I mean, I think that the things if you're struggling with your sleep, educate yourself. Find a reputable non-TikTok source of information for your sleep and learn about it. There's some great books out there.
Could you touch on some of those? Yeah.
I mean, my book's called The Sleep Solution, Why Your Sleep's Broken, How to Fix It. I think it's a little bit of a lighter, maybe more humorous look at things. If that's not your cup of tea, Jade Wu wrote a really good book called Hello Sleep. Brandon Peters wrote a really good book. Sleep Through Insomnia is the name of his book, which is a really good one. Sleep to Heal by Dr. Abhinav Singh is a great book. So there's all kinds of voices out there in terms of, you know, let's understand our insomnia or our difficulty sleeping at a little bit more of a higher level and use that as the base, the jumping off point for solving the problem. And the other thing that I would caution people to is that if you got a room full of people together and said, okay, I want you to raise your hand if you're a bad sleeper, and everybody raises their hand and you go around and say, if you have your hand raised, I want you to tell me why you're a bad sleeper, like what it is about your sleep that's bad. I'll bet you 90% of those people will tell you it's bad because it takes them a long time to fall asleep. So I think the other thing to understand about sleep is that I think bad sleep and truly dysfunctional sleepers are people who fall asleep fast. You know, your dad comes in, sits down, turns on TV to put the Yankees game on and is immediately asleep in the chair. You know, or you all go to church, you know, every now and then. And the reason, one of the reason why you don't like to go to church is when we bring dad insists on sitting in the front and he goes right to sleep in the pew. Like, you might look at them and think, oh man, Mr. Smith, he's a world-class sleeper. No, he's probably either got something wrong with his sleep or he's not getting enough, because this high motivation to sleep is indicating a strong drive, an excessive drive to sleep. And in our current media culture, we strive for that. You know, I wish I could be more like my husband. Why? I mean, he's asleep before his head hits the pillow. It takes me 20 minutes to fall asleep. Okay, well, we can deal with your problem. I need you to get your husband to come in here too. Why is he asleep before his head hits the pillow? Because he's not getting enough or there's something wrong with it. So you've got an individual with insomnia who wishes they could do what this dysfunctional sleeper could do. I wish I was so good at eating I could eat food out of a trash can. Said nobody ever. Like, right, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, when you look at that person who's in the dumpster, you don't thinking, wow, incredible eater. You're thinking, oh, poor guy, starving to death. Let me get him some food and spare a few bucks for him, get him a nice meal, because he's clearly so motivated to eat, he's eating trash essentially. But when somebody sits down and immediately falls asleep in a meeting, we got to stop telling them they're great sleepers. They're trash sleepers. There's a term, trash sleeper.
Could you touch on some other common misconceptions that maybe the media feeds about sleep?
Yeah, I think that another one is if you wake up in the night, you've got a problem. Maybe. You know, if you're like, look, I wake up over and over and over and over again during the night, sure, you have a problem, maybe. But yeah, I wake up once or twice, go to the bathroom, get back in bed, takes me 5 or 10 minutes, I fall back to sleep again. I don't necessarily think that's a huge problem. I hear doctors telling people, hey, you know, stop drinking fluids after 2 p.m. so you don't wake up to pee. What's wrong with waking up to pee? Wake up, pee, go back to sleep, and live a hydrated life. It's great. Like, I mean, so the bigger issue, I think, if you wanted to sum it all up, is it's a fear-based system we work in. And I guess that's how, I mean, not to be naive about it, I guess that's how the media works. Fireworks factory blows up. War in Ukraine destined to go on forever. Learn how this, you know, thing could be killing you if you're eating it. You know, all this and more. It's all just fear, 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 and a 30-second heartwarming story about a guy who makes dog collars and donates all the money to charity. That always ends the broadcast, the feel-good moment. But the other 28 minutes are just terror, fear, all the things you have to be worried about, threat alerts, you know, robots are taking over. I remember this great Saturday Night Live sketch. It's so good. It's about robot insurance. This guy comes on and is like, are you worried that robots are going to take over your house and eat your grandparents' pills for energy? Like, it was this, you know, they had this whole thing about buying insurance against a robot. It's so good. Anyway, I always think about that when I watch the news. But I think sleep operates like that too. It's fear-based. You know, do this, you get dementia, do this. And so I think a lot of it is just, look, we're going to have good nights and bad nights. And let's try to have more good than bad. And if we see patterns of a new repeated, I wake up over and over during the night, I keep falling asleep during the day, then just talk to a sleep specialist, you know. But I think most people are probably closer to better sleep than what they realize. I think the other misconception that you could throw in there is sleep trackers. I think they're okay. They're not perfect. They do a pretty good job of calculating how much you sleep. They don't do as good of a job in terms of breaking down, okay, this much deep sleep, this much dream sleep. But then again, when you start getting that information, what do you do with it? Okay, I got 22% deep sleep tonight, but three nights ago it was 18. What do I do? Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. Like, so I think that sleep tracking can be a positive thing, but we always want to pose a question to it. Like, you don't believe me when I say alcohol is bad for your sleep. That's fine. So wear a sleep tracker and just note your tracking score, how much deep sleep you get, et cetera, how much fragmentations in your sleep or whatever on the nights when you don't drink, and then note it when you do or drink heavily and decide for yourself. I mean, if you're like, look, Chris, I feel like I'm getting way more deep sleep when I drink heavily and I feel awesome the next day after I drink heavily, I'd love to hear from you, man. Like, well, let's have a talk about it because I don't see that, you know. And, you know, again, it might not ultimately change your behavior. You might look at that and be like, ooh, it is bad. He's right. Like, wow. But it might alter it a little bit. Like, maybe you'll think twice about having the seventh beer and stick to four instead. I mean, that could be meaningful. Or you'll try to have them earlier in the evening rather than closer to when you go to bed. So, not, you know, I like little changes in people's behaviors. You know, I'm going to try to smoke one pack of cigarettes instead of two. I can do that. Okay, great. So start there. It's better than nothing. You know, but I think it sometimes kind of turns people off to hear, don't drink, wear these funny glasses at night, no TV 2 hours before you go to bed, no alcohol, like, just, you know, just move yourself slowly in the direction of more positive sleep and better health. I think it's a good thing to do.
That's great advice. I think that's a really important and key idea there. So I know that you've actually had a couple of TED Talks before, but if we take a hypothetical situation in which you're asked to do another TED Talk on short notice, what would you choose to talk about, and what would the main idea be, and why would it be that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think thinking about that format and it being really short, I think that I would do a TED Talk entitled Why We Need to Stop Saying the Phrase Can't Sleep. I think that would be the thesis of the TED Talk, in that newspaper articles, water cooler conversations, we use the phrase, well, man, I've not been sleeping lately, or I went through a period a couple of years ago where I wasn't sleeping. Really? You weren't sleeping, or you weren't sleeping well? Man, I went through a period when I broke up with that girl. I wasn't eating. Yeah, you were, because you wouldn't be here telling me this story you've told me a million times. Every time I see you and you have a couple beers, you start telling me about this girl that broke up with you. Like, you would not be alive if you weren't eating. You may not have been eating well. You're eating crap food. You're eating sporadically, but you're eating. Give me a break. You gained 30 pounds after the breakup. You were eating something. So it's not heartache that's causing your weight gain. So I think that would be the thesis of how we would all be a lot healthier, and doctors would have a better chance of helping you with your sleep problem. I think you get more out of what we can give you if we just eliminated that phrase. We don't talk about that anymore. And so, and we know we can do this. We've eliminated a lot of things from the English language. Things are just not cool to say anymore that 50 years ago we were saying all over the place. Even my alma mater, you know, we would, this terrible thing, like, when you'd sing it, it was this chant that was just so out of touch. And we fought really hard to get people to stop doing that chant with this, our alma mater. And it eventually kind of happened. People stopped doing it. So we can eliminate things. We've done it before. So I would love for us to stop saying can't sleep. And I ask every patient who walks through my clinic door, hi, Chris, I'm Chris. How can I help you today? Can't sleep. I mean, you have no idea how many people tell me that. I'm like, and I always ask, when you say you can't sleep, what do you mean? And sometimes they're like, well, you know, like, I just don't sleep really well. Okay, well, let's start by saying that. Because every time you say to somebody at a dinner party or at a meeting or a family phone call, oh, dad still can't sleep, it's perpetuating this myth that all of your kids are hearing it. Oh, man, my dad can't sleep. And then they grow up to be kids. I can't sleep. I remember when I was little, my dad couldn't sleep either. We all just can't sleep, like, or whatever. but it also reinforces it with yourself. And it changes everything when you start saying, oh, I guess I sleep, but I just don't like how long it takes me to fall asleep, or I feel like I'm fitful at night, or I actually sleep really well, I just don't feel particularly energized the next day. So now we're getting a much better starting point for our sleep journey. Because there's a lot of people out there, a lot of doctors, when they hear, oh, you don't sleep, well, then let me go in the back and find a pill that will knock you out, which is exactly what we did with Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson, man, I can't sleep. King of Pop, Billie Jean, PYT, can't sleep. You know, and he's getting ready to go on this tour. He's got all the kind of legal problems and image problems. And you can imagine the stress this poor guy's under. He can't sleep. And instead of doctor, I mean, Michael Jackson probably got access to the best doctors in the world, I would think. They just gave him sleeping pills and eventually said, well, maybe we should just send a surgeon to your Neverland Ranch or wherever you're hiding out these days, and we'll just give you propofol until you become unconscious. That's our solution for the King of Pop. And they killed him. So regardless of what you think about Michael Jackson, just the case study of we as doctors killed somebody because we failed to understand that when he said, I can't sleep, that's not what's happening here. That's not the reality of the situation. When he does the moonwalk, doctors, he's not literally going to the moon and walking. He's doing a little illusion with his feet that make him look like he's being pulled backwards by an imaginary force. He's not on the moon. When he says, I can't sleep, he can sleep. It's just, you know, being fragmented and tormented by all of his grief and anxiety and stress about the tour. Whatever. So it happens all the time. So that's my TED Talk. Somewhere.
I love that
idea. There's a TED Talk. There's something, you know, if it's a TED Talk. That's an Ed Talk.
That's a good idea.
Ed. It's a Fred Talk. I never heard of it. It's where, you know, you're not good enough to do a TED Talk. They send you over to Fred. You do a Fred Talk. I think that's a Fred Talk.
Well, I like the main idea because I definitely, I hear that a lot too. I can't sleep. Like, okay, sure. Yeah. Sure, bud.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Okay. I'd like to just transition into two more questions. The first one being, if you were to be given the opportunity to put in a quote or to put a quote, idea, phrase, anything on a billboard that millions of people could see, what would you put on it and why would you put that on it?
Yeah. I don't know. The pithy one would be, it's impossible not to sleep, or something like that. Like, if you think you're not sleeping, it's impossible not to sleep. I think that'd be but I think the better one, the one that would actually help more people is, if you're struggling with your sleep, there are professionals who can solve your problem, or something like that. Like, it's amazing how many people are not aware. Like, if you had a skateboard accident and there was a bone sticking out of your leg where it shouldn't be, I don't think anybody thinks, well, I can do this myself, or, you know, gee, I wish there were people who could help me with this situation. Everybody knows, oh, there's plenty of people who can help you with this. And they're real doctors and they have real training and they're going to patch your leg up and put a few screws in, it'll be better than new. I wonder that everybody knows that about sleep specialists. And not to diminish anybody's life's passion, there's not a lot of people out there who just read a couple books about orthopedics and now they do that just for fun too. Like, the woman who lives three houses down, she cuts hair out of her garage. And then the guy next to her, he'll set your bones and put a pin in them because he read a few books. He just does the operation in your garage just, you know, for $50. Like, nobody does that. So when somebody says, I went to this woman and she pinned my knee back together, everybody knows exactly who that person is. She's an orthopedic surgeon who did 4 years of medical school, 4 years of, you know, you know exactly what you're getting. I think that for a lot of people, sleep specialists, they don't know what that is. It's the person who kind of coaches young mothers and how to get their babies to sleep better, but doesn't really have any kind of formal training in it. To people that I revere who've been involved in sleep research for 50 years and will have forgotten more sleep than I'll ever know. Both of those people call themselves sleep experts, which is kind of, it's a tough, I'm sure nutritionists feel the same way, like a doctor of nutritional science and has their RD and, you know, versus the celebrity who wrote a cookbook who's now a nutritional expert because she wrote a cookbook that sold 10 times more than the doctor of nutritional sciences book that nobody ever heard of because he doesn't get to go on Oprah and Reese's Witherspoon's book club of the money, whatever. So I think that the billboard would be something like, there are some really smart, well-trained sleep specialists in your area that can help you with your sleep problem. So don't suffer in silence. Don't feel like your TikTok video is the only thing you have to go on. Like, there's somebody out there who can, I mean, sleep problems are generally pretty easy to fix. You know, they're not death sentences. They're not, you know, terrible lymphomas. They're not, you know, disfiguring burns. I mean, we have very good success dealing with sleep. It's just, I often find myself asking the question, what took you 15 years to get here? 15 years, you've just been pounding trazodone and Klonopin and all this stuff that some rando person's given you. Like, and they're often like, I didn't know you existed. So anyway, there you go. There's the billboard, my big face on it. Exist. We exist. And we love what we do.
So on that same note that you just mentioned that you love what you do, how would you define success as kind of like the final question?
That's a great question. I think that I would define success as there is a financial component to it, but I'll tell you this. I think the financial component is having what you need to take care of yourself and the people around you at the most basic level, because the fact of the matter is, I think at some point you always want more money. Like, you always feel like you need more. So outside of that financial rider in the definition, to me, I think you achieve success when you find enthusiasm and growth with what you do. So, and I find both, that I'm excited about what I do every day. It changes all the time. It's really kind of fun to think, if you and I talk in a year, I have no idea like what things are around the corner. I just got called by a university yesterday, big university. Like, we want you to come spend a couple of days with us. And so I did 5 days ago, I had no idea that was coming, and bam, there it is. So I like that element of surprise, excitement. Every day is a little bit different. Again, we're not replacing knees, you know. But I also find that I bet if we talked in a year, I'm better at what I do. I've learned more from my peers. I've learned more from my patients. And I think that if you're in any field and don't feel like growth is happening, it's probably time to either change your field or retire. If you're not interested in becoming better and learning from somebody junior to you, that's fun. When the 30-year-old's like, yeah, we don't do it like that anymore, old man. You know, like, I don't want to be that old. I want to be cutting edge as long as I can be. And that takes a sort of openness to learn and grow. So yeah, I would say growth and enthusiasm in what you do and still being able to pay a mortgage.
Exactly. Well, any last thoughts, requests, or ideas to leave with my audience?
I would say this. When it comes to that financial piece, if you truly love what you do, and you're enthusiastic about it, and you're growing, I don't see how that part doesn't fall into place. At one point, my father was a phys ed teacher. At one point, my youngest son said, I think I'd like to be a phys ed teacher. I said, that'd be great. I said, my only request is, if you're going to be a phys ed teacher, I want you to strive to be the best phys ed teacher. I want you to be innovative. I want you to be excited about your career. I want you to make it such that it's constantly evolving and you're bringing new elements into it. Because if you don't, I think you're ultimately going to be dissatisfied. Not because of being a gym teacher. I think that'd be a great job. I was always interested in teaching. Both my parents were teachers. My wife's a teacher. I love teaching. But you've got to have that passion piece and that enthusiasm. And if you do, I don't think I've ever met somebody who didn't possess that in whatever field, carpentry, consulting, accounting, sleep medicine, whatever, painting, that didn't see pretty amazing success because people want to be around that energy. They want to be around you. They want to bring you into what they're doing. And so if you manifest that, you're going to be ultimately successful. I'd love to meet the person who is just bringing it every day to their career. Love it. It's so, and then they're really struggling. I don't see that. Usually the struggle might be sort of an indicator you're not on the right path yet. It doesn't mean, you know, the first path has to be perfect. You can work a job for 2 years and be like, yeah, this isn't the dream job, but I'm learning something from it. I'm perfecting people skills. I'm getting some valuable experience of what it's like to pay a mortgage and income tax and personal property tax on this car I bought and put gas in. Like, you're going to learn from everything. But I think ultimate looking for that passion and that growth is what's going to get you the security and the money we all kind of look for, I guess.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you talking with me today.
Hey, my pleasure. I appreciate it, Charlie.